Good evening, ladies and gentlefers. Welcome to the South Africa podcast. You're listening to myself, Ivic Wolf, here, and my co-host is Scratch, as always.
Yo.
And this evening we have Red Cap Goblin slash Copper Sphinx slash what else can we call you by?
Oh, you can say Carmen.
Carmen. All right. She has been involved in the furry fandom for, I believe, the last 20 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Since community college days, I believe, yep. as you might have mentioned. Okay. And, we're very happy to have you on. Maybe you should, or maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yes. I was first an artist and, was doing a lot of writing along with the characters that I created, and probably by community college days then I just started to pay more attention to the writing, but now I'm slowly getting back into the artwork as well. As I said, I'm a furry and I'm very happy to have found out about this community, to know that it's also global, which is fascinating to me. And also it's been very supportive to me over the years. And, you know, I credit the furry fandom for helping me out in a lot of ways that I didn't expect.
Okay. And I mean, it's obviously it's been a while, but I mean, like, how exactly did you find out about the fandom in the first place? Like, what exactly was the draw?
Well, as I said, I was always, you know, drawing, and a lot of my characters did tend to be animals. And what happened was, by community college, what happened was I was in an English class, and the professor gave us an assignment about an early childhood memory. And the assignment I turned in, she was so impressed by it. She said, has anyone told you that you're a writer? And I said, I've had reading and English teachers tell me that that my assignments are good, but no one ever really encouraged that. So she told me to sign up for, when it was my time to take an elective, to sign up for a creative writing class, which at that time, believe it or not, was one of the first times I had ever heard of creative writing. No one had ever mentioned that to me in high school or in even junior high. So when I signed up for the class, the professor who was teaching it was so impressed by my aliens and by my gangster dogs that she told me I should start to put these things out for a possible publication, which no one had ever basically told me before, or even a teacher. And so I put out my first a story called Suling, and it was of course rejected by many other science fiction and fantasy magazines at the time. When I then found one on a forum called Paw Prince Fanzine, and so I sent it to them, and then I forgot about it and then concentrated on other things. And a few months after, the editor reached out to me by email, because we didn't have social media as we do now, and said to me if I was Carmen Welsh, and if I had written this story of this talking Siamese cat. And I said yes, and he basically said I would like to publish it. And that was my first publication and my introduction into the furry fandom.
Okay.
Good way to get introduced, seriously.
Yeah.
Welcome to the furry fandom. Here's a paycheck.
were there even paychecks back then? I mean,
there was contributor copies, and it depended on, I guess it depended on how much circulation the magazine or the fanzine had. Most of them were pretty much, I guess you could say, like a one-man band, or, you know, two friends putting it together. So most of them could only give contributor copies and acknowledgement. I didn't, but I'm sure there were paying ones, but I just didn't get published by those at that time.
Okay.
Still though, good to, it's good to get your name out there, and like that being your introduction, like that's that's I can't think of the English version of the idiom I'm thinking of.
What's the Afrikaans version? Maybe I can help you.
The Afrikaans version is you fall met your gat in die botter, like that's
okay.
Yeah, that's like a really lucky break, lucky first time break.
Like serendipitous or something.
Yeah,
probably serendipitous.
Like, it's a lucky break. Yeah.
Yes.
The direct translation for those of you who are listening is you've fallen with your ass in the butter.
Yeah, you've landed with your ass in the butter.
Yeah.
Languages are weird.
But yeah, no, they definitely are. I mean, who'd have thought that that's the equivalent of something like serendipitous? But I mean, dip. I guess that could work.
No. Yes.
All right. So I mean, you've done short stories, illustration, fan essays, fanzine articles, and the odd comic strip. So I mean, amongst all of that, like, where exactly did you sort of? I mean, obviously somebody approached you. They said, you know, have you heard about this? In essence, we'd like to publish you and everything like that. Like, how did that sort of drag you into the furry fandom? What exactly was the, where was the draw into that? I mean, it's all good and well somebody publishes you, but I mean, how did you then become active within the furry fandom?
As I said before, for most of my life, I've been drawing talking animals. And so, but I thought, I was, and even among fellow artists, because I also majored in art in community college, even among my group of, you know, other artists, I was the odd one out because no one else was doing that. So when I realized that there was, when I got published by that fanzine, I started to do research because I saw the term furry popping up many times, and also they were also using the term anthropomorphic. So I said, let me look into that. Let me talk to forums and see, because I couldn't, at the time, I couldn't really talk to anyone about it. And so I started, you know, frequenting a lot of, you know, net forums and talking to a lot of people in the fandom and see who popped up and ask, you know, questions. And that's basically what I did. It was, as you said, a lucky break for me. But when I realized that there was this whole world that I basically should have been a part of, because I was always doing that. So yeah. Once I realized there was an actual community out there and it was an actual genre, then I said, I might as well just throw myself all into this, because this is basically what I have been doing all my life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, that was like 2000. Yes. Not necessarily sure now. I think that should be around about 2019, 1998.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, by this point, places like, I think it was the Muck, for instance, Furry Muck was booming at that point.
Yeah.
With the Telnet servers and everything like that. Mm-hmm. Were you ever part of those groups of people, or was it more along the lines of just emailing whoever was speaking to you, or how exactly did you sort of, like, you know, move into the, yeah?
I was basically just what I guess the term they would use now is lurking. I was just basically I was never officially a part of those groups, but they did provide me with a lot of information, and I did lurk, and I did, you know, ask questions and email people and maybe post comments and say, by the way, what does this mean? What sort of magazine should I read, and what publications are out there? And a couple of the comics that I was reading at the time, because I'm also a comic book fan, was I believe it was called Furlough.
Yeah.
That and then that turned out to be some of the cover, the covers to that was actually being done by, I believe, the very first editor who published my first story. His name was, I believe, Conrad Wolf. Conrad Wong. Sorry about that. Yes.
Yeah. I'm laughing because
his friend I believe was called Wolf, but yeah. spelled differently. I can't remember exactly his name, but I do remember that Conrad was the one that published me, but he was also the one doing some of the covers for Furlough Comics, and that's okay. How I got more into it. Yes.
Is that Furlough with a W or a O-U-H-G?
I believe Furlough, like a military term, but then they put an extra R in it. And it's, I think it was F-U-R-R-L-O-U-G-H. Yeah. I think that's how it was spelled. Mm-hmm.
Antarctic Press, continued by Radio Comics, edited by Ellen Winkler.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
Your Funny Animal Anthology.
Mm-hmm.
First published in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, I was reading them too. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And I mean, like, back in those days, it was kind of like the Wild West of furry everything at that point. Like, it was all out there, but people weren't necessarily accepting them, much like, I guess, the Wild West in and of itself. And I mean, like, how what was it like back then? Like, what was the atmosphere like? What were the people like?
I all I can say was that I didn't officially, I wasn't fully into the fandom or fully in the fandom. I didn't feel like a member until I joined the guild. And as well as when I started getting more things published, but I for a long time, I just felt like an observer, a spectator, mm-hmm. and also I couldn't really talk to anybody about it back then, because as I started to talk to more people and I started to realize there was a lot of criticism of the fandom, there was a lot of, I guess, outside forces, so to speak, that were mm-hmm. very critical, very, I guess, very aggressive towards the fandom. So for a long time, I felt I couldn't really join any groups, but I didn't really see any, and no one was mm-hmm. really calling themselves furries back then. So basically, most of my exposure to that was online, and so therefore I didn't feel I was a part of the fandom. Like, I was just a spectator.
Okay. I mean, that's very interesting to hear, because I mean, with the fandom as it is, and I mean honestly in its current state, it's definitely got a lot easier to sort of talk about it. I know for one, I as a lecturer sort of talk about it fairly often to my students, but then again, I mean, maybe that's more the entire idea that, and I guess maybe that's also the change in the way that people view English lecturers, for that matter, or English professionals, particularly because, I mean, it's this entire idea like, oh, you're an English lecturer, you're supposed to be quirky and awkward and weird about these things, and you're supposed to be connected with this and that and those people, and if you don't know them, well, I'm going to show you who they are. And you kind of sit there going like, 1960s Ferlinghetti gets thrown at you, and you're sitting there going like, oh my goodness, this person is rash.
Yes.
For instance. And but I mean, even then, I mean, that came out from the 1960s, for instance, but the entire idea, and I guess maybe it sort of starts there, is that like the idea of being a language professional, either as a writer in any kind of sort of like position in there, is always that you're a little bit different. But then again, I mean, like, I would assume that even in those days, being a little bit different only goes so far.
Mm-hmm.
And with your particular position, I mean, like we've spoken to, and jeez, what time for me to forget a name? Look at the articles.
What did they do? Maybe I can help out.
To see Mickey Bamboo, for instance. No. Mickey Bamboo as well, but I'm trying to find a name, and I'm sucking at it currently.
What name was their occupation? Is... Maybe I can help out.
It's not Tanya, it's not Trace. It's not Alias. Is it Alias? No, it isn't. Is it Mickey?
We had Mickey on last week.
Yes, we did. There we go. Ebony Leopard.
Oh, right.
Yes. That's the name that I was trying to... I'm so bad with them. Ask me to remember a birthday. Please do. I can barely remember my own damn anniversary, so...
But can't confirm, so, you are not good at remembering dates.
Yes. I'm going to mention this to you, Scratch. When I asked you as to whether it was the 17th of July versus the 17th of June...
I know. It was a joke.
Yeah. It was a joke? But it was semi-serious.
God damn it, really?
But yeah, so I mean, like, with people like Lamont or Tamar or Ebony Leopard and things like that, I mean, he's been around for practically centuries in the furry fandom. There were initial difficulties, I'm assuming, that, I mean, there weren't enough people who you could sort of connect with in respect to that. Maybe talk through that a bit. Like, what exactly was the... I mean, and, like, I'm... It's mostly because I'm attempting to sort of, like, I guess maybe create a narrative, which is probably not necessarily the best idea. But there is a narrative that does say that in the early 90s, the furry fandom was 99.99% white. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of people were very, very difficult to sort of find within those areas. People who were able to sort of understand the positions that people were in. And I mean, how did that sort of like go with you? What was the feeling? Oh, not to mention the fact, I mean, 99.9% white and 99.9% male.
Yeah. As I said before, I didn't, I believed, I felt as more of a spectator.
Yeah.
And it was, I guess, it was accepted by me and others who, I guess, didn't fit the definition of somebody of a fan. Because remember now that I also said I was a comic book fan. And so there, I guess a lot of the sociologists throw around the word nowadays intersectional. And it's very true that everything is connected. If I am already part of other fandoms like superhero comics and maybe science fiction and fantasy as well, and I already see that these fandoms are only maybe probably about like 80 to 90% white as well as male. So what I guess as I personally, as a fan, I don't know what other people did, but I had to just possibly search for, I guess, for others that were different, for some type of connection. And also, I think for a lot of fans at that time, it was just a matter of survival, of just accepting what we thought was the status quo, what we believed status quo, and just accept it and move forward with our own, you know, with our own, I guess existence and our own, you know, narrative and story. So I don't think I've ever really thought about that. That's a great question that you asked me on that. Because I really just believed that I was just basically surviving in both the furry fandom as well as other fandoms. And I felt I was a spectator. I didn't feel like a true fan at the time. But because it was all that I was, then I just went along with whatever was there and whatever information others could give me.
So, obviously, in your bio that you've given us, you speak about anthropomorphic canine characters surviving both the Prohibition and the Great Depression. What exactly do you sort of mean by this? I mean, this is your master's thesis. What exactly were you attempting to sort of get at here?
Well, I'm going to shamelessly plug my MFA program.
Go for it. Go for it.
It's with the University of Tampa. And when I decided probably around 2011, 2012, I wanted to see if I could get my master's. But I'm one of those people that I want my degree in something that I actually like. So that's why I have the art degree, the web design degree, and things like that. I don't want to take the degree that because everybody else is doing it, or it's because it's the popular degree at the time. So I was like, since I've been writing for so long, let me see if I could, if I can enter an MFA program. So I was doing a lot of research and looking around, and what happened was I sent in. I had been writing this story for many years now. I'm embarrassed to even say that it was an idea from most of my the stuff that I'm publishing, that I'm getting published now, are actually, most of them are childhood ideas. And I just, of course, upgraded them, and they're written, of course, differently as an adult. But it was an idea I had been playing around with, and I couldn't. It wasn't going anywhere as far as a novel. And so I kept putting it aside until finally I said, you know, if I don't get this out here and get it validated by someone, I'm just going to give it up, because I felt I had other ideas and other stories to tell. So it didn't feel like such a loss to me if I put it away. So when I was looking for MFA programs, one of the things they want you to do is to send in our writing samples or any list of publications. And so I sent it to a number of them, and University of Tampa's director at the time contacted me and said, oh, we've accepted you, and we would like you to be part of the program. And then I said, and then I realized it was because of the furry piece that I sent in. And and I was like, wow, that blew me away, because years before, furry lit wasn't even people didn't even acknowledge it. And as I said, only my community, community college creative writing professor was the only one that basically was the first person and only person at the time to acknowledge that. And so suddenly now I said, okay, let me join the program. So once I was in the program now, and what they do is, once you pass the entrance and you get in, they give you a number of mentors, people, professional writers and poets and memoirists and creative nonfiction writers. And I picked a few, but then they picked one for me. And he happens to be a German American who writes a lot of horror. And so my first term with him, I said, listen, most of my other classmates were writing short stories at the time, because I was in the fiction, I guess, module, you could say, because separated by fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. And I said, most of my classmates were doing short stories and other things. And I said, I would like to, and they were doing some horror, some speculative fiction and things like that, fantasy, science fiction. And I said, I would like to make this my only work, this story about these dogs in the mob. and I thought he was going to laugh and say, no, of course not, but he basically was all on board. And the funny thing is, he wasn't even familiar with the furry genre, but he found books for me, because we also had to be given a customized, an individually customized reading list for each term. And he pretty much went above and beyond. For someone who did not know or was familiar with it, he customized a reading list for me that was all incredible furry works. And and when I even mentioned a couple of things like Watership Down, can I read that? Read also Mouse by Spiegelman.
Art Spiegelman, and
he basically said, yes, I could add that to my reading list the second time I asked for him. So so that's, I guess that's basically what got me into, it encouraged me more to know that I was being taken seriously to write this. So that's basically what I say in my bio, that this story now, and it's been amazing, because I had to read a part of the story, part of the thesis for my senior term in the MFA program. And so what I did was, and I mentioned this on my blog, that I dressed up as somebody from the 1930s. And I read this piece, and I'm still at that stage where I'm already, I guess I did, it was 2 years into the program and I'm about to finish it. And I'm still thinking, you know, maybe it's not quite, I guess, self-consciousness. I didn't feel it was quite, and the whole room was hushed. The whole auditorium was hushed. And later one of the deans of our program approached me and he said, we loved it. You had us eating out of the palm of your hand. We loved the story. And another classmate approached me, and she turned out to be the editor of a literary journal that happened to have ended, and it was called Prick of the Spindle. And she said, I would like to publish the piece that you read to us. And so I said, yeah, okay, I'll do this. And so that's what I've been working on. I've been working on that story as well as others now. And now I feel more, I guess, emboldened to put out more furry things. And she also, the classmate who published, who was the editor of that magazine, basically thanked me for being the first furry piece that they published in their journal. So I guess you could say, you know, furry is now, I feel it's getting the validation now, even from, you know, academic circles and things like that.
Yeah.
Now more than ever, like the stigma is really disappearing.
Yes.
It really is. And but then again, I'm going to ask, particularly because, I mean, the 1980s had things like 1986's Red Wall, for instance, with Brian Jacques, and the work that he'd been doing, and so on and so forth. I mean, there was what was Duncan Tales also came out during this period. There was it The Wolves of Time, were all books that had all come out within, I think it was like the late 1980s, early 1990s, and things like that. I'm asking whether these are possible, what would I call it, influences or not? Influences in respect to the writing that you've sort of gone into.
The funny thing is, it's only been, I believe, several years ago that I started to know about. In other words, I came to a lot of these writers late. The ones that were actually influencing me, I guess in the early 80s and mid 80s and late 80s, was a lot of just the regular cartoons that that I was, one of the cartoons that I credit with wanting to write so much of my cat fantasy stories was Heathcliff and the and Cats and Company, which came out in the early 80s, and it was with Heathcliff and Riff Raff's Cadillac Cats, and that cartoon and we also had He-Man and She-Ra and all of these other, I guess, sword and sorcery related things. So all of that stuff sort of came together to influence me over time. There was just so many good furry and talking animal cartoons at the time, but as I said before, I didn't know what they were. I just enjoyed them. I even watched the animation of Watership Down before I even knew it was a book. You know, so it's a lot of these things of, you know, watching these cartoon movies and watching these cartoons, and I'm like, wow, these are really cool. And then I would write my own things, you know, the Adventures of the Gummy Bears, Disney's, all of these things were influential. And then I was also watching a lot of anime at the time, but we didn't call it anime, and we were just calling it Japanese cartoons. And I was watching a lot of that, and Tezuka was watching Kimba the White Lion, but we were calling it the Lion at the time. So seeing all of these stories from both the U.S. and Canada, and then even from Japan and even Europe. Europe was putting out a lot of furry stories, like one about a talking donkey. And up till now, I still can't remember which country it came from, but it was a donkey that was going on adventures and helping out the humans. And, you know, so all of these things I was watching. So I didn't even know about Redwall and a lot of, I guess you can say the notable people until years later, like maybe by the 90s, the early 90s and the mid 90s.
I mean, Redwall's animation only came out in 1999. And that's actually the weird thing is that it wasn't necessarily the animation that for me personally that caught my eye. Mm-hmm. I'd actually seen the book while I was browsing through a library one day, and I was like, this book, I need to read this one. And it was after Redwall, and I think I read Mossflower, Matameo, Salamandastron. Oddly enough, I skipped Mariel of Redwall for some reason. Martin the Warrior, for instance. I read all of these books, and The Long Patrol, for instance, and I hadn't realized up until, and I'd been reading these books for goodness knows how long, and then the series came out, and I was like, this series is ages old. It's, I mean, 1986, it's 2 years before I myself was born. And I hadn't realized this until, like, goodness knows how long. And so, I mean, like, it's actually amazing how sort of, like, everything, and I'm going to put it out like this. I think the earlier parts of what furry really is had a lot to do with comics, had a lot to do with books that were being put out that nobody knew would actively do what they did. I mean, ask Brian Jacques. Obviously he's honestly passed away. It's very, very sad. But I mean, ask Brian Jacques if he knew that would be the reason. No, wait, yes, he passed away in 2011. Ask him whether he'd have known that this would be the sort of like the end, his legacy. That he created an entire group of people who'd fallen in love with this idea of talking animal people. And in that same sense, I mean, we could ask you the same question. You'd started all the way in 2000 and, what was it, 2000 and, I, I, ask, I'm going to ask you, what year exactly did your books actually come out? Because I read here now in your blog, or at least in your, in some of the things that I'm following here, is that, I mean, it started out when you were pre-kindergarten almost.
Yes.
And I mean, that's, oh, let's see, pre-kindergarten, I need to do math. That would mean around about 5 or 6.
Yeah.
And that's 1980. No, is it 1980?
Yeah, could be. Yeah. About that.
Mm-hmm. I've kind of divided. minus 1980. Okay, pre-kindergarten, that would mean that it was about 1983. Round about there, 1983, 1984, that you'd started thinking about these kinds of characters and everything like that. This is, this for instance, if we had to say it, 3 years before Red Wool was created, 1986.
Yeah, you're adding on more. 1980 would have been, yeah, 1980 would have been, and it's because I was showing my mom kept my pre-kindergarten report card where they basically said in the comments that I was showing artistic proclivities. So, and I remember that one of my earliest characters, probably around 5 or 6 years old, was a cat with bat wings. So, and then years later in junior high, I find in the library Ursula K. Le Guin's Cat Wings. you're right. It's just so fascinating how the more I talk to people in the furry fandom, how we all came to it from so many different perspectives, because it was those cat wing stories too that helped, because then I realized, I'm like, wow, somebody else, I thought I was crazy that I'm, you know, writing about a cat with bat wings terrorizing, people in New York City, and because I was in, I'm originally a New Yorker, and. Mm-hmm. And then years from now, and I'm drawing this character and writing his adventures as a 6-year-old. And then years later in junior high, or probably like the ending of elementary school, then I see Ursula K. Le Guin's books, Cat Wings. So a lot of that was just validation with that. I was just like, wow, somebody else is just as strange and odd as I am. And their stuff is published, and maybe there's something to this. But as I said, nobody really encouraged. No one really, basically, I was just doing more of the artwork. So I wasn't, and even then, that wasn't even being encouraged either, because of the fact that I was doing, it was being encouraged, of course, by friends and family and things like that. But I guess the overall community wasn't encouraging, because first I was a girl, I shouldn't be drawing cartoons and comic books, and even more so, you know, not talking animals. So, but all of that came into perspective little by little with different people and different influences, because even the high school teacher, art teacher for, I guess, 11th and 12th grade, she was a cat lover, and she loved my cat characters. So, like I said, it was just there was no single body of work that brought me into this. It was just a period of many steps over the years, and by different people who I wouldn't expect, who would just pop up and say, by the way, you know, this is good. You should do this. You should read this. I was actually encouraged by my middle school librarian to, when she saw that I was reading a lot and I was hanging out in the library a lot, also to hide from bullies, because bullies almost never go into the library. And she basically said to me, you should read this book. And it was Tad Williams' Tale Chaser's Song. And that was such a, you know, that and and other books, a lot of these short stories and these these fantasy books and things like that. So when people say, oh, I got into this because of, you know, Tolkien, because of the Lord of the Rings, because of Narnia, because of Redwall, and then I say, yeah, but I kind of went in another way, where it was Ursula K. Le Guin, it was comic books, it was a Heathcliff cartoon, it was He-Man and She-Ra and all these things. This is what pulled me closer and closer to telling the stories that I tell now.
Uh-huh. And there's so many things I want to talk about now. Your poem, Only Hound Dogs Up in Harlem. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I haven't read it just yet, because it says we'll be out in upcoming Typewriters Emergencies issue.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly, what was the basis for that poem? I love poetry, so...
it was basically first it's from the dog Great Depression. It's from that Milo. It's from that universe. And also it's based on a lot of the Harlem Renaissance poetry at the time in the 20s, Langston Hughes, County Cullen, all of these. I've been reading and researching a lot of the different pop culture at that time in order to write the story. And I don't consider myself a poet. This is my first poem that I've published. And so, but I love poetry. And so I was so fascinated by it. I said, there should be a dog version, since these are dogs, of what Harlem Renaissance poetry should sound like. And so it's like I said, it's from, those are the different that's where it comes from. It comes from, it's a furry perspective of Harlem Renaissance poetry.
And I mean, I'm honestly, I mean, that's Langston Hughes and the you're bringing me back to my own university days when we were talking about poets like this. And again, I mean, like that's beautiful. Honestly, it's this idea of sort of a dream. Again, what happens to a dream deferred?
Yes.
For instance. Sorry. I mean, I'm a lover of writing that has to do with exactly this kind of stuff. It's that kind of thing that really sort of brings me a large amount of joy. Oddly to say that. I mean, and obviously, I mean, because again, we're both myself and Scratch are South African, but I mean, people like Langston Hughes, people like this motion, this movement within those areas, actively brought many, many people to the ideology of what freedom actively is.
Yes.
You're looking at the 60s and 70s and 80s poets of South Africa, for instance, who also wrote very, very much along very similar lines, particularly because they themselves were getting bootleg copies of these poems from overseas, to begin to speak about a completely different type of what freedom actively is. And that's something that really sort of like draws me into this idea that furry fandom, and definitely the furry fandom, mm-hmm. has so much potential,
yes.
to actively speak to this idea of what it means to be in some ways oppressed.
Yes.
This idea of either being ignored for whatever voice you actively have, and I mean for you it's doubly so, or triply even. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, one of our guests at one point, and Scratch, I'm gonna remember her name eventually. Witchy Bunny, yes. Mm-hmm. At one point said that, I mean, you have three strikes and you already have two strikes against you, mm-hmm. For just being black and a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something like that sort of like definitely places us into a position where we should be able to understand this.
Yes.
That we should be able to begin to sort of read books about this kind of perspective. And it's just very, very sad that, mm-hmm. we're unable to either bring ourselves to read,
mm-hmm.
in any sense for that matter, about this kind of plight. Because the thing is that if you were... and at the end of the day, fictional stories do exactly that. They goad us,
yes.
into reading about particular things like this. If you look at Redwall, and obviously Trace has been speaking to me about this for a couple of seconds about Redwall in and of itself, and he mentions this idea that his only complaint was the distinction between what vermin was and other particular species,
mm-hmm.
and that there was the singular fox character and his mate. They were both noble and trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
This in contrast with the usual portrayal of foxes as shifty, not to be trusted, and even then, though, the other characters regarded them with a particular type of suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly that kind of thing. You're looking at Brian Jacques, who created this idea that there are others, and those others are not to be trusted, who finally came forward and said, wait,
mm-hmm.
let's talk about this from the other side of the coin, and let's see exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that it's all this sort of power play, and that in and of itself, that's what literature is meant to do. It's meant to make you sort of sit up and go,
true.
There's a problem,
mm-hmm.
and these problems exist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful when somebody sits up and says, hey, these are our issues.
Mm-hmm.
Just for 2 seconds, listen.
Yes.
And I think that your work in and of itself is absolutely imperative towards that. I'd love to honestly read that poem, for instance, the... I'm terrible. My brain is not here, okay? Just stop asking. But yeah, only hounds, hound dogs open...
Harlem. Up, yes.
Yeah. Only, mm-hmm. hound dogs up in Harlem. I would love to read that because it seems to speak to something that I'd find absolutely interesting. I'm hoping, and when it does come out, I'm going to find it and buy it and like cherish it forever. But
if it's possible, I could read it.
Oh, sure. Why not?
Yes. And let me see if I can find it on my phone. And let's see. And when the link is available, I will also tweet about it and add to my my publication blog as well.
Awesome. Okay.
Okay. All right. So this is only Hound Dogs Up in Harlem.
Yeah.
And okay. A brief background about this poem. This poem also appeared earlier in it was Portland, Oregon's oh goodness, Furlandia's convention book.
Yeah.
Yes, so it came out, I believe, last year or so.
Furlandia, yeah?
Yes, Furlandia first published it in their official convention book, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, they say there are only hound dogs up in Harlem. Only chiseled mutts work down in Harlem. Only pit bulls gamble in Harlem. Only pedigrees go slumming in Harlem. There, the West Indies is in Harlem. There's South America in this Harlem. Mother Africa sits on her throne here in Harlem. This hound dog took the long way here. This little doggy came from hell, where they tore my hide, docked my tail, cut my ears, roped me, squeezed my life and spirit from me. And while begging, please, dropped me down in this haven called heaven, known as Harlem.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Just go for a couple of seconds, please. I'll be with you in a second.
All right. Sorry. Yeah, so I was going to say something. So when it says here on your Twitter profile that you are also part of the Furry Writers Guild, correct?
Mm-hmm.
When did that involvement start, and what is your, what is your sort of role, contribution, whatever there? How are you finding it? What are you, what are you doing with that?
Oh, I found out about the Furry Writers Guild, I believe I joined in 2011, and that, I contribute a lot of how I've been able to navigate the fandom because of them. I not only have they been has being part of that guild helped me professionally. I can ask them questions, I can get information. I've actually had two blog posts published by them.
Okay.
And it's been going very well. As I said before, I didn't even when I found out that this guild existed, I was so excited by that. I was like, okay, let me join up with them. And it's been a pleasure, and it's been an honor, and this guild has helped me to be more of a professional within the fandom, and to be able to market and brand and look at my works and body of publications in a different way.
Yeah, through the lens of not really monetization, but the corporate aspect of it. Not really corporate, but you know, the financial, commercial aspect of it.
True. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, it does sound like from what we've had quite a few people that were part of the guild, the Furry Writers Guild, on the podcast, and it sounds to be like everyone is getting value out of it. Like whether it's sort of proofreading and professional tips to publication ideas, like and spreading the word and using it as a vehicle for promotion. Like everyone's just like, that is just a well-oiled machine at this point.
Yes.
Could I? Yes, I'm back. Sorry about that.
It's okay.
Moment of weakness. Yeah. Could I ask, actually, now, Scratch, this might require something from you.
Mm-hmm.
Would we be able to, and I'm going to ask for your permission as well, could we possibly just, like, obviously we're going to upload this video, but if possible, could we cut the reading of Harlem, I'm going to call it Harlem from now on, and publish that as the live reading when the publication itself comes out. Hello?
Oh, you're asking me.
Yeah, I'm asking you.
Oh.
It's your work. It's
yeah. Oh no. I thought you were asking your podcast.
Yeah, I'm asking him because he would need to like cut it like time for time
we can cut it, but I mean if she gives us permission first.
Mm. Yes. That's a good idea. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, great stuff. So as soon as it becomes a published work, we'll... just give us the go-ahead.
We can put that out there.
Awesome. So let us know when it does actually become a publication. Okay. We'll definitely have it out as a live reading from you, I guess at this point exclusively to South Africa for podcast. Yay!
Speaking of publications, could you share a bit of I'm assuming through the Furry Writers Guild you have had some other publications of some things published either in like hard copy form or somewhere online. Did you share a little bit about that?
Yes, I have my official website, Tabber the Red, and mm-hmm. that has links to my blogs as well as to my art portfolio. So the blog that is attached to Tabber the Red is called theangrygoblin.wordpress.com. And that has, I try to use that to keep track of, and WordPress is very good at making things look professional and it has good networking and I'm able to then update latest publications on it. So I also have links to where some of the hard copies can be found and purchased or even downloaded. Mm-hmm. Would you like me to, I guess,
you can drop us the sort of the links to those publications, and we'll annote them in the YouTube video as well.
Okay.
So yeah, just pop them onto Skype, and then we'll get there.
Let's see.
excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sheesh. Like, I want to go back to the poem just for like 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
It does so very much remind of, like, again, Ferlinghetti, and can you believe I forget his name as well? It's Ferlinghetti, and they were both of the, it was 1960s, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And he both of them wrote sort of what could be considered epic poetry at that time, with these sort of the entirety of a repetition of a particular place, a particular idea, a particular sort of time and space and everything like that. And one of the reasons as to why I kind of sort of popped away is because I was immediately reminded of the kind of poetry that was written in those times. And I mean, yes, it was written by a vast majority of activists.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's sort of time to sort of segue into the idea of your activism, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So when and where exactly did you begin to sort of think about, making that a part and parcel of the kind of information that you need to sort of get out? At what point was that the idea that, these are fantastical characters, but the way that they act and react is very much a mirror image of what we as people need to begin to sort of take into account?
Well, in a nutshell, I credit with reading Aesop fables, and mm-hmm. Aesop was, I found out in my research of him to also write the piece, and I believe that the the guild, that was the piece that the guild published. Mm-hmm. And I talked about how Aesop influenced me as a furry writer, but I also found out that he had been a slave. And and he was from, they believe he was from Asia Minor or from one of those areas. So he wasn't, mm-hmm. he wasn't particularly Greek, I believe, as most of us thought him to be. So when I found that out, I was like, okay, I read this man's stuff back in junior high. He was always talking about his stories of talking animals was moral tales in order to mm-hmm. straighten people out, to say this is what you're doing wrong, don't do this. So once I then found out years later that he also had been a slave, but they had been so impressed by his you know, his acumen and his writing and his stories that he was given some more perks. Even though he was enslaved, he was given more perks to I guess put out his stuff. So I said, well, that's pretty much what I'm doing and what a lot of people in the furry fandom are doing. And just the fact that, and I mean, Art Spiegelman's mouse and even the guy who did Pogo, the very I believe it was a 1930s based cartoon or comic strip about the southern animals and talking about, you know, politics and corruption and things like that. So that pretty much, I said, well, if this is what where it came down to, where if Aesop is doing it and mm-hmm. all of these other people whose works I admire as well and read, then it would just make sense for me to be able to talk about social issues through the lens of furry, because as Aesop I know must have found out thousands of years ago, human beings, we tend to pay more attention when it's a cartoon character talking than if we hear from the actual, I guess, marginalized person or people or community. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and
it feels less like finger pointing.
Yes.
Or an attack, essentially.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I hear you mention people like Shaka Zulu and Eric the Red mm-hmm. as historical warrior figures, as some of your influences. And obviously, because we are South African, the idea of Shaka Zulu, for instance, being influenced thousands of miles away from mm-hmm. South Africa. Mm-hmm. Where exactly does sort of Shaka come into this?
Well, I watched the miniseries as a kid, and mm-hmm. so it just fascinated me, and I know he's a very polarizing figure, but it just was so fascinating to me at the time that whereas the narrative was often of a European perspective. To finally see a story from the African continent where there was somebody that actually not only united many nations into mm-hmm. one, but also fought against colonizers and settlers to the point where he was successful in so many ways, because unfortunately a lot of the narratives at the time that I was given was that as a Black person we must always lose, we must always when I say the narrative that I was receiving, I'm talking about from popular media, from pop culture, things like that, that we must always be on the losing end, our neighborhoods are messed
you're
up,
you're the other in essence.
Yes. and to finally see that as a little kid was very empowering and very, and in my family, we love history. And so we always, our parents always encouraged us to read history, watch documentaries, watch, you know, miniseries such as, you know, Shaka Zulu and things like that in order to understand, you know, the world around us. We not just to just look at things from a U.S. perspective, and especially by the fact that my parents are immigrants, but also to look at the world on a whole. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I took from. So when I started to craft my main character who names the whole of those short stories of cats.
That being Tabber, yeah?
Tabber the Red, yes.
Yeah.
I was very much influenced by my childhood fascination by Eric the Red and by Shaka Zulu, and even the fictional such as Conan the Barbarian and things like that. That was very influential for me as well as a kid.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's odd to say this, but I mean, the thing is that, I mean, many people in Africa, for instance, would believe for various reasons that somebody like Shaka Zulu was doing almost exactly what the colonialists were doing at the same time in the way that he himself the idea may have been uniting. I'm not necessarily sure. I'm going to say that the vast majority of my South African history in respect to Shaka Zulu, and this has a lot to do with the fact that my history classes never actively talked this to me. It was mostly just, you know, the Dutch East India Company and European and this and that 1985 syllabus, things like that. But I mean, like, a large amount of the time we skirted past, and my history book, I know, mentioned at least seven Afrikaans Zulu wars, for instance. It also mentioned the idea of the fight for Bophuthatswana, for instance, as well as Swaziland.
Yeah.
All of these things were mentioned in my history book, which was literally only about, if you had to take your thumb and your finger and you had to put them to round about the size of what you would consider to be tiny.
Yes.
That was the thickness of my history book in grade 11, for instance.
Yeah. That sounds like here too.
Yeah. So, I mean, and you miss out on so much of this extra information that could have been useful in respect to how we then raise the people that are supposed to take over the world, you know, next year, those kinds of things. I mean, I myself, I'm 30 years old at this point, and I'm sitting here going, like, I've gotten to the point where I can influence people at the age of 18.
Mm-hmm.
And get them to understand what it is like to be able to grow up within an area that is not going to be fair to them, not necessarily just on color lines, but on the idea that you're not necessarily even close to worthy of doing anything and being anything. And having stories about people like Shaka Zulu, having stories about people who sort of fought against a particular curve,
mm-hmm.
irrespective of how they did it.
Yes.
Very fact of the matter is that they did it.
Yes.
That in and of itself is the story that does need to be sort of like told to people, is that it doesn't matter how old you are, it doesn't matter what your capabilities are. I mean, goodness sakes, there are people at the age of 16 who are playing at like pro-level gaming arenas, yeah. for instance. Absolutely mm-hmm. wonderful players at the game that they're doing.
Yes.
But the very fact of the matter is that these people don't necessarily understand the kind of, you know, following that they should sort of understand why it exists. I mean, people like Alexander the Great, people who were at the age of 16 and led yeah. successful campaigns
yes.
into, it's phenomenal. It's
yeah.
phenomenal that we should be able to understand that it's not necessarily the age that necessarily matters.
No.
And it's not your color. It's not your... The entire idea should be that we are all equally capable of doing whatever it is that we can and want to set our minds to doing. And it's important that that sort of comes out as part and parcel of the information that we give to furries, for instance. I mean, yeah, yes. Many, many times you've heard, like, younger furries, the age of 16, 15, 14, 13, 12, if you want to go that far back, who sit there and say, I am terrible at what I do.
Mm.
And yet we're looking at you, for instance, who, again, at the age of 3, 4, had created entire societies that have absolute sort of control over what they do and the way that they control their lives and things like that. And that's something that people need to begin to understand is that if we can understand the idea of what the human condition is,
yes,
we can understand how to fix it and we can understand where we need to go to do that. And I think that that's terrifyingly important in respect to the work that you do.
Yes.
I'm going to try to segue because at this point I've sort of taken over a conversation that I'm not necessarily sure where it's supposed to be going. And that is, of course, the nature of our podcast in and of itself.
Yep.
of course, you'd agree. But, I mean, you've done so much, and where do you want to go from here? What exactly would, if I could ask, what kind of legacy would you like to leave behind?
Wow. now that's really fascinating because I don't even. I'll tell a funny story.
Mm-hmm.
Where. When who was I talking to? And I was talking with an editor of of Anthrozine or which is now folded, and I can't remember which of the furry anthologies that it was. Maybe it was Anthrozine. I don't. If it's not, I apologize. But I remember when he was going to publish one of my things, and I said to him, do you want me to also, as part of my biography, do I send in, you know, my publications from the earliest days? And he said something to me that I found very, it threw me into, I guess, perspective. And he basically said, yes, the younger furries need to know where the classics came from. And I suddenly went, wait, I'm considered a classic now. So, yes.
So you're still alive.
Yeah, but apparently, I guess in the timeline of the furry fandom, my works are considered classics. So just you asking me what legacy would I like to leave, I'm like, wow, it is fascinating to me because when I watch other author interviews and other creator interviews, and I hear they're usually like much older and everything, so it's fascinating to me that the furry fandom, I guess you're considered so influential, you know, I feel still young. So, so for you to ask me that, I'm like, wow, I never really, I don't even know if I've been thinking about that. I've just been thinking about, where to take my writing, which level to take it to, who to, and I'm getting back, as I said, into my drawing, which I'm doing as far as trying to do maybe graphic novels and short comic strips and comics. But if I guess if I were to say a legacy, hopefully to let people know that this world, this genre, this community is for you. I'm also a college tutor, and I work in the college lab, and I am basically using my artwork, my website, my writings as a platform to my students, who are oftentimes maybe youngest at 17, 18 years old, to let them know that this can be done.
They meet me
and they have ideas about they already feel that everybody who teaches in a college is a professor, and I have to let them know, no, that's there's different levels of instructor, and but at the same time they have this idea that if you are teaching in a college you must be this way. So when I let them know, when they talk about video games, when they talk about comic books, when they even I've met other some of my students who happen to be furries, then when they find out that I'm one of them, then they go, really? You like these things? So I let them know this can be done. It can be credible. It can be viable. It's whatever it is that you want to do. As you said earlier about the human potential. You in whatever it is that you must do and that you feel your destiny is, you can do it. And you know, in putting into consideration your possible limitations and other things. But I always go with the Clint Eastwood saying, where he said a man's got to know his limitations. And people will probably think that that's because I feel it's true probably also in South Africa, that we're a very individualistic society, and we're given the narrative, you can be anything you want to be. And I have to let people know that's actually more dangerous, a perspective, or at least in other words, I feel that the motto of knowing your limitations and knowing where your strengths are, that is important, because then you know where to put your energy, your talent, your skill. I feel too many of us are told you can be anything you want to be, and that's not necessarily true. You find where it is that you have your strength in, and your abilities and your community. And this is why when you asked me earlier about what got me into the furry fandom so quickly, it's because of the fact that once I realized that there was a need and a for someone like me, for my stories to be told, for my artwork to be acknowledged, then I jumped into it. So I don't, so when I hear other people say I had bad experiences being a furry and therefore, and then I keep letting people know, I said, I'm sorry that it happened to you, but it's all, but it's been more so of a wonderful thing. I've always had good editors. I haven't, I guess maybe now because the earlier furries fixed it and made it so that now for somebody like me, it's now been polished. It's now been made comfortable. It's now been made more accommodating. So I feel, so this is what I let my students know. They must find their group. They must find my MFA program said, find your tribe. And that's basically what I tell the students. I say, I don't give them the thing about be all you can be. No, I basically say find your group, find who validates you, who accepts you, and that's who you cling to. And so I guess that would be my legacy, to let people know what they're doing, whatever it is that they're doing, find the people who will validate you, and you can do it. And no matter what anyone's saying, whether you're getting support from family and friends or not, there are people out there that will give you the support, give you the nurturing, give you the community that you deserve.
Mm. And I mean, and it's one of the fascinating things about the furry fandom, in that it, irrespective of who you are, and I mean this goes as far as the far right, the far left, doesn't bloody well matter.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to find a group of people that will accept you, and I mean it's as much as it is a divisive point, it is important to belong, and the thing is that so long as you feel comfortable in a particular area, if you're comfortable, you're also more than willing to listen to other people's criticism. And it's something that I myself have actually sort of like figured out, is that I feel comfortable in particular positions. And if I'm in a position of comfort, I feel so much more willing to be able to listen to criticism, for instance. I mean, put me into a one-on-one conversation with somebody, you'll find that I think at least 90 to at least 95% of the time, will be more than willing to listen to what's being said and how it's being said, rather than listening to, you know, what they're attempting to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
Just listening, that's one of the most important things. And I mean, like, as a writer, I only write random poetry every now and again. But I mean, it's something that we do need to sort of take into consideration, is that as a body of work, it exists. And the very fact of the matter is that irrespective of our political leanings, irrespective of whatever sort of positions we're in, the very fact of the matter is that we would like to be known.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I, for one, would hope that maybe one of these days that at least my name is known as a person who started a successful convention, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Or anything along the lines of that, that my name is connected with something that sort of says something about success.
Yes.
Not necessarily because I want to be successful, because, I mean, success in our day and age currently means I make more money than everybody else does. That's apparently what success means, and that's bullshit.
Yes.
Money does not include success. In fact, very, very many rich people have committed suicide, particularly because they were successful. And you sit there going, like, what is this? What is this new information that's being given to me? Very fact of the matter is that success is knowing that whatever you're saying is heard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the reasons why at least I so desperately wanted you on this podcast. And I mean, I'm going to say we, because I think Scratch and I sort of share very, very similar views on this.
Uh-huh.
Is the idea that being able to have a voice, being able to say what we need to say, is terrifyingly important.
Yes.
And sometimes the message may not necessarily hit all the right buttons with the right kinds of people or whatever. Fact of the matter is that you've said it and it's out there, and that's important. And I think that's one of the most important things, and it's one of the reasons why we, for instance, caught on to your Twitter, because you were saying things that were important.
Yes.
We can't sort of stand idly by and not allow that voice to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And the media that you put out, the kind of writing that you put out, the kinds of passion. In some ways, it's almost sorely missed amongst what I would consider to be furry smut. because I mean, and it's one of the reasons why, for instance, Kyle Gold
yes.
is as influential as he is.
Yes.
Is because it's not just porn. It's porn with meaning, and that's
yeah. yes.
so weird to say.
No, but yes. Mm.
And it's one of the reasons why I believe that your writing has exactly the same kind of sort of connection. I mean, you wouldn't be part of the Writers Guild. You wouldn't be part of the Association of Writers and Writing Programs or the International Women's Writing Guild if it weren't for the idea that what you said and what you were saying had meaning.
Mm.
And that's something that we need to be able to begin to laud a lot more. Our writers, for instance, I feel are getting sold so short in that they're not getting enough airtime to be able to say what they need to say in anything but this like fanciful universe that they've placed out there. And it's one of the reasons, again, why your Telegram, why your Twitter sort of intrigued us mm-hmm. is because it was saying things far beyond what you were doing. You were stepping... In many senses of the word, far beyond the means that should be given to a writer for some reason. Oh, no, you're a writer. Oh, yes, no, you should only, you know, say these things. It's like you're standing around like Stephen King going like, oh, no, I'm going to talk about the like latest movie I'm going to like produce. What happened to your purpose? Because that's the thing. Once you become famous, there is no purpose, is there?
No,
you're almost... pigeonholed.
Yes. Yeah.
And from our side, I think that the idea that, I mean, many people in their 40s, for instance, unable, absolutely unable to remove themselves from the years that they themselves grew up mm-hmm. towards the idea of being an adult.
Yes.
And I think that it's a definite story that we need to be able to begin to sort of talk about, is that it doesn't matter how old you are, you're able to sort of adapt. And that adaptation is extremely important. And I think that that's one of the reasons why your writing is important, at least from what we've heard so far as well. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. I think that... it's necessary, and we really do thank you for. I'm not trying to wrap up, but weirdly enough, it sounds like I'm wrapping up.
Well, it is about time.
It is the time to wrap up. Yeah. But then again, I mean, if you do have anything else that you'd like to say, of course, please do. But from our side, it's terrifyingly inspirational to hear somebody from again the 80s, the 90s of the fandom. Sort of to step up and go, we do still exist, we're still here, and every now and again we do kind of like wrap our hands around our heads going like, the fuck?
Yeah.
And I mean, again, if you do have any statements, if you have anything that you'd like to say or anything that you'd like to push at this point, do go right ahead. You've got the floor. Sorry that I've randomly taken it.
It's okay. Yeah, no, I thank you for reaching out and giving me an opportunity to, because I do feel it's important. As I said, I've been influenced by so many different people in different media over the years, and I found that as you were also saying, voice is important. I feel it doesn't make much sense that if you are somebody out there, if you are producing something, even if it is fiction, even if it is, as you said, in a weird universe, you still must have something to say about the state of things. And so Twitter has really helped me to be more, because as I said, I'm an introvert. There was a lot of things that I feel I could have been involved in over the years. And social media has really helped me to to come out more to let people know this is what, in other words, I've been given the microphone, basically. I have been told you have a voice. I've been told this, in other words, I have been encouraged as well as pushed to say you have something to say, where for years my voice was curtailed and shut down and things like that. So I feel at this point that with a lot of people telling me and encouraging me and pushing me to say, you have something to say, please say it, we need to hear it, then that's what I'm going to do. And I always tell people, you can't complain if you don't do something about what you're complaining about. And that's been my motto for years, that if something irritates you, if something annoys you, if something frightens you, if something angers you and disgusts you, you need to speak out. And especially by the fact when it harms and hurts others, even if it doesn't particularly hurt or harm you, I feel that things reciprocate. There's a domino effect, and so therefore you, what was it? Oppenheimer said that they came for all these different people, and I did nothing. And then when it was time for when they came for me, there was no one to stand with me. That's very important. I always tell people to, you know, stand up for others, even if they are not necessarily a part of your group, because as I said before, I was bullied, I was pushed around for various reasons, and so therefore I said when I got older I was not going to put up with that, and so that's what I'm doing now. Any sort of bullying, any sort of phobia, any sort of bigotry, I feel it's my time to say something about it. And if I have to say it with talking animals and in a story and in a comic strip, or, you know, on social media, or even to the world at large, I'm going to do that.
All right. Okay, so obviously we allow our guests to sort of plug whatever they're doing currently, anything that anybody who's listening, and anybody on YouTube for that matter, who would be listening sort of in the future. Is there anything that you'd like to plug? Is there anything that you'd like to sort of talk about that might be coming out soon? Writing, opinion pieces, anything along the lines of that? Is there anything that our listeners are going to be privy to soon?
Yes. Well, we already know that the poem is Only Hound Dogs Up in Harlem is coming out, of course, in Typewriter Emergencies. And I also would like to mention my website, Tabber the Red, which I always I use as the basis for all these other links where people can find me. So that's Tabber the Red, TABBERTHERED.com, but you can also type in .net and .org. And also, you can also look for, I'm noticing that people are also asking for my past works. And so basically, you can go on The Angry Goblin, .wordpress.com, and that gives, and there's a publication list link, and that and I believe I also sent it to you through Skype, and that is also all of my past and present publications, articles, comic strips, essays that I've had published on various things. As well as I also have the links to where you can directly buy these. And because I've published in some of the literary journals, a good number of them are available to purchase on Amazon. So if you want to read, if you want to know the influence of the poem, I have two short stories that have been published. One in Prick of the Spindle called Sleeping with Wolves, as well as Night Sounds. And those are from the Dog Gangster story, as well as all of the cat stories that I, from the Tab of the Red universe that I've had published. All those links are available, and I make sure I'm the one that's responsible for this. I don't have the the funds yet to pay somebody else to do this for me. So all of this is me, and so I try to, you know, keep everything up to date, everything like that. And if anyone sees a link that may be broken or whatever, so please let me know on the blogs and things like that. But pretty much I just updated everything maybe 2 months ago or a month ago. So everything should be okay. And as soon as the poem is available, I will be posting it not only on Twitter, but also on other social media, including adding it to theangrygoblin.wordpress.com.
All right. And we'll speak after the podcast in respect to just the nitty gritty of that, particularly the poem itself. And thank you so much for joining us this evening. We really do appreciate it. Obviously, it's evening by us. It's early to mid-afternoon for you.
Yes.
We really, really do appreciate that. The chat itself has actually also, Trace says, thank you so much for your presence. It's absolutely amazing to hear this, and really, we really do hope that you continue to further your art in whichever way it comes out. We really do appreciate it. It's absolutely amazing. And thank you so much for being on the podcast with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And I'm assuming, Ivic, as usual, you're going to be playing some music after this.
As usual, yes. Should be within about 10 minutes after this ends.
Yeah, and then we shall see you guys again next week then.
Yes.
Cool. See you around, everybody.
Cheers, guys.